I read a fair amount of book reviews, just trying to decide what to dive into next. But when I came across a couple recently that raved that this new book about patent law was a real page-turner, patent law, I thought, yeah, we'll see about that. And then I started reading about the long legal battle over who has the right to claim ownership of human genes, and I realized the reviews barely did it justice. It really is a fascinating story with implications for every single one of us. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. George L. Contreras wrote this book, which is called The Genome Defense, Inside the Epic Legal Battle to Determine Who Owns Your DNA. Contreras teaches intellectual property, science policy, and the law and ethics of genetics at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, which makes him the perfect person to untangle the complex scientific, moral, and social questions tied up in the filing of patents for genes that occur in nature. George, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the idea of patenting a gene, I think, strikes many people as preposterous, in part because we wonder what the advantage would be of holding such a patent. So start by telling us why any company would be willing to spend millions of dollars trying to own the rights to a naturally occurring human gene.
Right. Well, there's actually a lot of money involved in owning the rights to a human gene. If you own the rights to the gene, then you have the right basically to every therapy, every diagnostic, every test that relates to that gene. You can be the only company that tests for defects in the gene, that creates therapies using the gene. So it's potentially an enormous market that you could get if you get such a patent.
And if you're not the only one making those tests, you can sort of lease out the rights to other companies to use it.
You can do that, or you can hold the market exclusively for yourself. The owner of a patent has the right to decide.
Is the patent holder also, would that person also have exclusive rights to replicate that gene?
Absolutely, absolutely. The Patent Act gives the holder of the patent the right to make, use, or sell whatever that patented substance is.
All right. So what role does the ability to reproduce segments of DNA play in modern genetic medicine? How important is it to be able to do that?
Well, everything that we do in biomedical science that has to do with genes involves replicating the genes, right? Genes are obviously very small. You can't just look at them with an ordinary microscope. Any kind of diagnostic that we do with genes means we multiply individual genes by millions of times so that there's a chemical effect that we can see.
How did you get hooked on this story, which revolves around a case known formally as Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics?
Yeah, these patents that are involved in the case go back to the late 90s. And I've been in the patent field for a pretty long time. And I was aware of these patents, as were most people in the field. And they hung around for quite a while, and we'll talk about what that meant for people. But I knew about these genes, and then when the ACLU brought this suit in 2009, I and everybody else kind of perked up and said, "Well, what's this about? What's going on?" That suit went through a lot of twists and turns over the years, and I got more and more interested until finally I realized this is a huge story. And it's something important and something that, shouldn't just be left to the experts, right? Ordinary people, ordinary readers ought to know what's going on here.
So people have a sense of what's at stake. A couple of the genes Myriad wanted to patent included BRCA1 and BRCA2, known as the BRCA genes, both of which are associated with an increased risk of breast cancer, right? So what did Myriad want with the patent on these terrifying mutations?
What they wanted was to have the exclusive right to test people's genes to see if they had these mutations. If you know you have one of these BRCA mutations and your risk of getting breast or ovarian cancer is increased by something like 8 to 10 times in some cases, then you may decide to take preventative measures. This is where women will get prophylactic mastectomies or oophorectomies or take prophylactic chemotherapy to prevent themselves from getting cancer later on.
All right. So as you alluded to, another thing that makes the story really intriguing is a sort of unlikely cast of characters wrapped up in it. The ACLU is not the first organization we think of when we think of patent law. Just to go back in time, even before this, how had the ACLU decided to bring on a scientific advisor for the first time?
So that's an interesting story. You know, when the terrorist attacks of 9/11 happened in 2001, there were a lot of civil rights issues floating around in the air, and the ACLU was very active in fighting those, surveillance, Patriot Act, Guantanamo, and so forth. As a result, they received a lot of donations. Their budget increased dramatically. And so the director of the ACLU at that time staffed up and doubled the size of the ACLU's national office staff. And, you know, there had been science issues kicking around for a while within the ACLU, online speech and going all the way back to the Scopes monkey trial in the 20s. But they had never had a science expert on staff. And so this was a perfect opportunity, they thought, to bring on someone who could help guide them to think about what are the scientific issues that we might want to get involved with, everything from DNA fingerprinting and cold cases to, you know, MRI brain imaging and whether that indicates guilt or lying to this, gene patents.
So who was it they hired for that job?
So they hired someone who was, it turns out, perfect for the job, but an unlikely candidate. Her name is Tanya Simoncelli and plays a critical role in this story. At the time that she took the job, she was a graduate student or a former graduate student at Berkeley in environmental policy, working at a nonprofit that did genetic policy issues, put on conferences about that, and actually was on her way to MIT to enter the PhD program in science policy when someone sent her the ACLU's ad for a science director. And at first she thought, you know, no, I've got my career mapped out. I'm going to go do this. But eventually she was persuaded and went to the ACLU, and they loved her. And in 2003, she was hired as the first ever science advisor at the ACLU.
So she was exceptionally well qualified. On the other hand, it must have been peculiar to be the sole scientist surrounded by 100 of maybe the most driven lawyers in the country.
It certainly was challenging. I know from having spoken with her many times and with many of the colleagues at the ACLU, you know, I think she was highly valued and respected, but also was an outsider to some degree because she didn't have a law degree. Lawyers, especially high-powered lawyers like those in New York at the ACLU, you know, sometimes look with skepticism at people who don't have that qualification.
So how did she strike up this working friendship with Chris Hansen at the ACLU?
So Chris Hansen was this senior litigator on their national litigation staff. He had handled a range of high profile cases, Brown versus Board of Education, a follow up case. He went to the Supreme Court with the online pornography cases. And he was sort of a guru at the ACLU who liked Tanya Simoncelli and who advised her occasionally. And she, you know, she knew that the ACLU was in the business of bringing litigation. Lawsuits is what they do. And he was a person who she occasionally went to when she was looking for ideas, like how could you bring a lawsuit to deal with this or that issue?
So Hansen hadn't even realized that the U.S. Patent Office had been allowing applicants to patent human genes for like 20 years by the mid-2000s. How had this been going on under the radar screens of much of the country at that point?
Yeah, Chris Hansen, not only did he not know about it, he didn't even believe it was possible. He thought Simoncelli was wrong when she first told him about it. But the answer is really surprising. So this practice was well known if you were in biotechnology or if you were a patent lawyer. You know, over the years, since the 80s, incrementally, the patent office kept allowing more and more different types of patents, each one sort of incrementally broader than the last. And so if you just looked at this little series of steps, you wouldn't really think that much is wrong. And most people, not most, almost every 99.9% of the people in the biotech industry thought this was fine and actually a really good thing. There were plenty of patent lawsuits going on among biotech and pharmaceutical companies and universities about these patents, but there was always an assumption that the patents were fine. It's like maybe this company's patent isn't valid because, you know, it whatever it's claiming wasn't already discovered or somebody invented it before. But the whole idea of these patents was accepted by everyone in the industry, all the patent lawyers and the patent office. So from inside, things looked like they were fine.
So being bothered by the implications of patented genes is one thing. Finding grounds to challenge those patents was another thing entirely. What did the ACLU need in order to make the case that it might be unconstitutional to grant these patents?
Right. So the legal case, there were a lot of other issues floating around in this litigation, but the legal case had to rest on the idea that the genes that were being patented were not human creations, right? They were not like the oil company bacterium, which actually got modified so that it liked petrocarbons better and would break them down more, right? These are not modified genes. They are occurring in nature. And, you know, there has been a longstanding rule in patent law since the 19th century that you can't patent a product of nature. You know, you go into the forest, you find a new kind of mushroom that either is really tasty or it might cure diseases. You can't patent the mushroom. You just found it. You didn't invent it. And that's where their case had to rest. They had to convince the courts that despite the fact that this gene was being isolated and purified and coming out in a form that didn't exist in human cells, it was still a product of nature, couldn't be patented.
But based on the legal precedent that had allowed for patenting genes in the past, it makes me think about maple syrup, right? The nature invented a maple tree. I can take the syrup out of there and purify it. Does that allow me to ask for a patent on maple syrup?
No, and there is an early 19th century case about maple syrup. And you can certainly, you know, the spike, you invent a new type of extra sharp spike that penetrates the tree and drips the syrup into your bucket. That's patentable, certainly. The bottle, you know, all of that sort of stuff is patentable. But the syrup itself, even if it's purified syrup, you take out the bugs and the bark and the twigs that are in there, should not be patentable. But as these things go, there are always cases, you know, that start to get into the gray area. And one of those cases that was really problematic for the ACLU and that, you know, Myriad put a lot of weight on involved adrenaline, human adrenaline, which was actually the first blockbuster drug back in the early 20th century. People would take adrenaline to cure everything from headaches to morning sickness to muscle cramps. And a company did get a patent on a purified form of adrenaline. And the courts, a very famous decision by one of the giants of the judiciary, Learned Hand, in New York, he said, yeah, the purified form of adrenaline, that can be patented. And so you've got these two competing strains of cases, some like maple syrup, you can't patent it, some like adrenaline, well, maybe you can patent it if you purify it enough. And, you know, this is a complicated area. There are lots of cases on either side of this line that the ACLU had to sort through and try to build their case on.
Learned Hand, by the way, is a spectacular name for a jurist, isn't it?
he was a giant in the field. And there's a picture of him in the book. His eyebrows are especially impressive.
All right. So how did the ACLU start casting about for a particular case that might allow them to effectively challenge the laws that allowed the patenting of human genes?
Yeah. So for better or for worse, by 2005, when they were seriously thinking about this case, these MIT researchers canvassed the patent system and found that about 20% of all human genes already were patented in some way. So they had a lot to choose from, right? When you bring a lawsuit, you you pick a particular defendant, and they had to pick one. And so there were lots of diseases. I said cystic fibrosis, and they could have challenged the University of Michigan for its patents on cystic fibrosis, but you know, those really weren't hurting anybody. There were some patented genes where the situation had, they really were hurting people. There was one especially, a patent also discovered by the University of Utah on a gene related to a pediatric cardiac arrhythmia called long QT syndrome, which is an irregularity in your heartbeat that is fatal in infants and children. The good thing is that if you detect this arrhythmia, it can be prevented, right, by simple beta blocker drugs, which we have and which are pretty cheap. But if you don't know you have it, you have no reason to, you know, prescribe your child beta blockers. And so it was believed that, you know, now that we have this genetic test, that we're going to save lots of children's lives. The catch was that the company that the university exclusively licensed this patent to went bankrupt. So it wasn't performing any tests. And the trustee in bankruptcy, who was overseeing the bankrupt estate, they wouldn't let anybody else use the patent, right? Because they need to conserve value for the creditors of this company. So for 2 years, no one was running this test, and literally children were dying. And that seemed like a pretty compelling story to tell, and a company and a patent that should be challenged. But it was really Chris Hansen and others at the ACLU, including Anthony Romero, its executive director, who said, no, long QT syndrome, this is terrible, and it is tragic. But, you know, in all honesty, no one has ever heard of this disease except a few people who, you know, have children who were affected. To mount a serious civil rights challenge in America, a case like this, we need something big, something that everybody knows. And looking down that long, long list of patents and diseases and sort of what was happening out there in the market, breast cancer. It had to be breast cancer. It had to be the BRCA genes that Myriad had, both because Myriad was an exclusive provider, it would not let anybody else operate under those patents, and because breast cancer is such a pervasive disease in the United States. Everybody knows someone who has died or has recovered from breast cancer, and so they felt that was very important.
So they found this woman named Lisbeth Sirianni. What was her experience?
So Lisbeth Sirianni lives in Newton, Massachusetts, and she was one of the first people who the ACLU identified as a potential plaintiff in the case, right? The ACLU wouldn't bring the case in their own name. There have to be people who are actually injured by these patents to bring the case. And, you know, they put out the word through various channels. Lisbeth Sirianni had worked in the insurance industry for a number of years, but she had taken some time off to raise her child, and was, you know, living on a limited income, and was on Medicaid, right, for her health care. It turned out she did develop cancer, and there were indications that she possibly was a hereditary cancer, and she you know, it was recommended that she get the BRCA test to determine, for one thing, what type of cancer it would be, also whether her daughter might have that same risk. Because, of course, if this is a genetic hereditary disease, it runs in families. When people find they have one of these mutations, it's important for their family members to be tested. But to make a long story short, Myriad was charging a little over $3,000 for this diagnostic test. Medicaid had only been willing to pay $1,500 for the test, and Myriad would not come down in price. And so Medicaid patients in Massachusetts and all around the country were unable to get the test. You know, that became a serious problem. She was very angry about this, was very interested in joining the ACLU suit when she was approached for this reason.
So they're off to the races. At one point, Myriad got in touch with her and offered her a test. And I guess they assumed that she would pull out when that happened.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of questionable things happened during this case. Myriad did have a variety of low-income programs, or at least they said they did. There's been some debate about how many people they actually went to, but they did roll out a program in Massachusetts for low-income people to get the test. And so Lisbeth Siriani did qualify then. And then, yes, she did get a call from a Myriad rep asking if she wanted to, if she was still going to be in the suit now that she had gotten her test, which was positive, by the way. She did have this mutation. And she said, forget it. I'm in this lawsuit. It took you 3 years to get around to doing this. I'm going for it.
How important was public opinion to playing this fight out?
I think it was immensely important. And that I think the ACLU had banked on, and why breast cancer was the disease that they focused on. It's not important to the specific patent law issue involved. Like, is this a product of nature or not? There are, cases and statutes and patent office decisions. That's what the legal arguments are about. But in a case like this, that is possibly going to the Supreme Court, right? The Supreme Court only hears 2% or so of the cases that get appealed to it. It can decide which cases it wants to hear. And you want to situate yourself so that the court is going to want to hear your case. And the fact that the ACLU did a lot of public outreach, they were on 60 Minutes, they were on the Today Show, they were on PBS, they were all over the media. Even, Angelina Jolie, the actress, had come forward during the Supreme Court a battle to talk about her BRCA mutations in a New York Times op-ed. All of that was very important to raising awareness, getting the court to pay attention to the case.
It's interesting that the novelist Michael Crichton, who is perhaps best known as the guy who brought us Jurassic Park, got involved in this fight too.
Yeah, Michael Crichton was involved from pretty early on in this. He wrote a whole novel, Next, about genetic engineering and companies that were getting patents on genes, and has a diatribe against gene patenting in that book, which came out in 2006. And tragically, that was his last novel. He died in 2007.
So the case first went to the court of Judge Robert Sweet. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
And what happened there?
So Judge Sweet was a district judge in New York. The same court, by the way, that Learned Hand was on when in the early 20th century when he allowed the adrenaline patents, right? So interesting coincidence. Judge Sweet, who was 88 years old at the time the case was brought, heard the case, and he held that the patents were invalid. He, together with his law clerk, who purely by coincidence was a guy who happened to have a PhD in molecular virology, pretty rare for a law clerk, but this was one of the many coincidences and twists of fate that made this case so interesting. They came up with a theory that, chemical bonds and substance aside, that the DNA sequence of the gene outside of your body and inside of your body, it's the same sequence. And that's really all that matters. It's the information in the gene that matters. And because that sequence, that information appears in nature and the company didn't invent it, those patents are invalid. You cannot get those patents.
So, of course, it's not over there, and we'll get to what happened in a moment. But obviously, in this case, Myriad Genetics was the target of the lawsuit. What role did the U.S. Patent Office that had allowed these patents in the first place play in this? Did they take a side?
Oh, they definitely took a side. they were one of the defendants in the case at the district court level, but the district court dismissed them. You really can't sue the patent office for doing its job. So at that point, they were outside of the case, but the government can intervene in cases, and they do all the time. to express their opinions in briefs. And those briefs are very influential. And so the patent office wanted to do this. But to do this in the federal government, an agency has to have the permission of the Solicitor General's office. And the Solicitor General is the United States' top litigator in the Department of Justice. And so the patent office did go to the Solicitor General, explained what this case was about, said, we issued these patents. We've been issuing them for 25 years. We want to submit a brief in support of the patents. And then something really strange and amazing and unprecedented happened, which is the National Institutes of Health, led by Francis Collins, the cystic fibrosis gene person who also had been in the race to find the BRCA genes. He and others at NIH and other agencies told the Solicitor General, you know what? We should not be getting patents on these genes. This is impeding scientific research. And so the Solicitor General had 30 different governmental agencies within the administration talking with it, lobbying it, either to support the patents or not support the patents. And this culminates in a big meeting at the White House where a number of high-level people are involved. And finally, the Solicitor General comes down mostly on the side of the ACLU in this case, which is enraging to the patent office, but also but quite unprecedented.
When you say mostly on the side of the ACLU, what does that mean?
Well, the Solicitor General tried to do what lots of decision makers in this area do. They will try to make a compromise. And so the compromise that they reached was clever, but mostly favored the ACLU. And the compromise was that the big long string of DNA in the gene, it appears in your cells, and so it's not patentable. But if you construct in the laboratory just a portion of that DNA, what's called the coding regions of the DNA, which is a small part of it, and it leaves out some of the in-between bases that don't really do anything in the gene, then that would be patentable. I mean, the problem is but for Myriad, that was, getting the sleeves off of your vest, right? Because they didn't make those cDNA constructs, they're called. They use the whole gene. And for diagnostic testing, you need the whole gene. So it didn't help them at all, but it did at least make the Solicitor General look like the administration was reaching a compromise.
So what did it take for this case to finally make its way to the Supreme Court?
Well, it took a couple of tries, but without going into laborious detail on the procedural aspects, Hansen and his team did convince the Supreme Court to hear the case with a four-word question, right? The question that was presented to the court that they decided to hear was, are human genes patentable? That was it, and the court took that bait and decided to hear the case.
So how did the justices respond? What did they need to know? I mean, how well-informed did they have to be about the science behind all this in order to make wise decisions?
Well, the Supreme Court justices are some of the smartest lawyers in the country, obviously, but they are not scientists. And some of them like science. Justice Breyer, for example, is a big science fan, but he's not a scientist either. And so the justices, they have to read the briefs, which are full of information that they need. But the most interesting way that they get educated is at the oral argument, which is kind of a theatrical performance in and of itself. And they ask questions to the lawyers who are arguing before them, who each have, 20 to 30 minutes to make their cases. And they analogize, right? The justices love to create metaphors and analogies to try to get a grasp, a layman's grasp on very complex scientific and legal principles.
Do you have favorite analogies that came out of those arguments?
I do. I mean, these enrage patent lawyers, right? But Justice Sotomayor, in this very down-home kind of way, asks how these gene patents are different than, chocolate chip cookies. where the ingredients are all products of nature, but when you bake it and make it into a cookie, well, maybe that's something different. Justice Roberts is a baseball fan, and so the baseball bat is his analogy. And, you know, you've got a branch of a tree. Of course, you can't patent the branch, but you chop off the branch, you carve it into a baseball bat. Can you patent that? But the best of all of these was Justice Alito, who then starts to riff on the baseball bat and poses this question. Well, counsel, suppose that there's a branch in a tree and it falls into the ocean and the natural forces of the waves carve that branch into a baseball bat. And now it's a baseball bat. Can you patent that? You know, these questions are ridiculous to some in some sense, and they often baffle the like highly skilled litigators who are there, but they do make the arguments a lot of fun.
Okay, we have kept everybody in suspense for nearly an hour now. How did the court rule?
The winner of the case is the Solicitor General, Justice Thomas, who writes a unanimous opinion, right? The Supreme Court, as you probably know from lots of other stories, doesn't come out unanimous that often these days. This was a unanimous 9-0 decision that held that genomic DNA could not be patented, but a cDNA construct that you make in the laboratory could be patentable. There was only one footnote to this decision, which is Justice Scalia, who wrote a three-sentence concurring opinion in this case that basically said, what are we doing here? Like, none of us understand this molecular biology. Why are we writing this opinion? Essentially is what he said.
8 years on, has there been any chilling effect on genetic research by private companies that can't patent the genes they work with?
So this is highly debated. And both pro and con, right? We do not have patents on human DNA sequences anymore, at least naturally occurring ones. If you go to any biotech conference, you will hear that the industry is being destroyed. There's no more venture capital. No one is investing in companies like this. They can't get any patents. I mean, that being said, companies like Myriad Genetics are still alive and well, doing all kinds of things. Their tests are still being ordered. The prices have come down. Somewhat, but they are still not free. So there's still a lot happening. That said, there are because of the lack of patents, there have been a variety of efforts recently to overturn these cases in Congress, which Congress does have the right to do, and bring gene patents and DNA sequence patents back to help the industry a little bit more.
So the story is far from over, it sounds like.
It is a continuing saga. Now, that's right. Just a couple of months ago, the Patent Office issued a call for public commentary on how are these Supreme Court cases harming or helping your business, soliciting input as requested by a couple of senators who are interested in these questions.
George L. Contreras, excuse me, teaches intellectual property, science policy, and the law and ethics of genetics at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. His new book is called The Genome Defense, Inside the Epic Legal Battle to Determine Who Owns Your DNA. George, this has been really interesting. Thank you for spending this time with us.
Chris, thank you. No, it's been a lot of fun.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. And if you want the podcast, you can find it free wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think. You can also listen anytime on our website where we'll tell you about upcoming shows we're planning. That is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.